open the hearing today for, we'll open the Business and Labor Committee. May I have some quiet, please? The House Interim Committee on Business and Labor will open, and we'll start with a public hearing today on pay-per-visit systems for nursing staff. Our first panel today is Jack Dempsey, Sue Hendershot. Is that correct?
Hendershot Link.
Hendershot Link. Oh, I'm sorry. And is there someone else, or is that just two of you?
There's just two of us for now, and
okay.
Three others that are going to come up after us. So thank you, Chair Escobar. My name is Jack Dempsey. I'm here today representing the Oregon Nurses Association. We represent about 11,000 nurses statewide, including about 500 home health care nurses from Medford to Ontario over to Portland. We're here today to talk about how some home health employers are choosing to pay their nurses. Pay-per-visit is a model where nurses are paid based on the number of home patient visits that they can squeeze into a day versus a more traditional model of an hourly wage. The nurses with me today will talk about how this doesn't work in their workplace, but essentially nurses are having to choose between maintaining the ethical standards of their license versus their employer's quotas. This is a healthcare issue, and the patient quality is being strained. But the underlying...
Excuse me for interrupting, yeah. Mr. Dempsey, but you mean to tell me that employers are dictating to nurses that they have a certain quota to do for healthcare?
That's correct. And
I went to Medford High, you know, we weren't... I just want to make clear. Okay.
Like I was saying, this is a healthcare issue and the patient quality is being strained. But the underlying issue is an issue of employment and it's an issue of professional standards for nursing. So I want to turn it over to Susan Hendershot-Link, who's a nursing practice consultant with ONA, to give you a little background on the issue. And then we'll bring in some nurses from the field that can talk about how this works in the workplace. So.
Good morning. I want to thank you for hearing me.
State your name, please.
I'm sorry. My name is Susan Hendershot Link. I'm a nursing practice consultant with the Oregon Nurses Association. My responsibilities at the Oregon Nurses Association include providing consulting and research services. And two members of ONA, the 11,000 or so members of ONA, as well as the nursing community, including nurse educators and nurse researchers, as well as to our ONA labor representatives and staff. I've been with ONA for only a short time, about 6 months. But during that time, I had a privilege of working with a number of home health care and hospice nurses and ONA labor representatives working with those nurses through their bargaining units and health professionals. And as a former home health care nurse myself, I was very surprised and concerned about the issues that they describe, that they will describe to you in a few minutes. As a nurse researcher, I began to investigate those issues because I wanted to learn more and find out what was the story behind some of the stories that I was hearing from them. I also wanted to look at the evidence of how this might impact Oregon and the people of Oregon as we begin to prepare for a very serious nursing shortage that's going to be occurring in the next 10 years, and I'm sure you're well aware of that. And what impact this might have on the home health care nursing workforce that we're going to need during that period. Just as a little bit of background, home health care represents a very small, about 3% or so, of the total amount of money spent by Americans on health care. So this is a small amount. There's I think in your packet you see in Figure 1 a graph that looks at the expenditures for health care and the categories, percentages, and so forth. that is represented by our expenditures. 37% of our health care dollar goes to hospitalization. Home health care represents a very small percentage. However, the demand for home health care services is expected to increase dramatically as baby boomers like myself edge toward retirement. And many in this generation are moving toward a preference to receiving home health care or health care services, not home health care services, and treatment at home. So there's going to be an increase in demand for home health care services. I think we can anticipate that. Oregon leads the nation in the numbers of people who have chosen to die at home. And that's something that is something that these people that are going to speak today are directly involved in that process for a number of cases. These individuals who choose to die at home and their families and friends are supported by the invaluable resource, the knowledge, experience, dedication, and compassion of home health care and hospice nurses. In light of that, the issue of pay per visit is what brought us here today. And what we found is a number of Oregon home health care agencies have proposed, and some have adopted a pay per visit system of reimbursement for home health care and hospice registered nurses rather than an hourly wage. This move toward pay per performance or pay per visit actually began in the late 1990s. But in July of 2000, with the introduction of the Healthcare Financing Administration payment system for Medicare, Medicare is the largest single payer of home health care services. They account for 37% of home health care payments. So they are a very good player in this situation. And figure two looks at payers, looks at percentages of where the money for home health care services come from. In any event, in 2000, the Medicare Administration introduced a prospective payment system, or PPS. Medicare expenditures are critical to the financial viability of the home health care industry, as Medicare is the single largest payer. I already said that. These changes by Medicare and by CMS were motivated by a need to make Medicare expenses more controllable and predictable than they had been under the previous fee-for-service system. This change resulted in a shift from per-patient visit home health care billing to lump sum payment for each patient based on episodes of care. Episodes of care were defined as 60-day periods, beginning at a point when the patient was enrolled in the home health care agency services and corresponded to an initial evaluation. That evaluation is called an OASIS evaluation, or outcome assessment and intervention set. And it relies on a case mix kind of process to set payment rates based on the patient characteristics, specific and individual patient characteristics, including clinical severity, diagnostic category, functional status, and need for rehabilitative services. There are a number of other characteristics that go into the calculation of the OASIS evaluation. One of the strategies used by home health care agencies to deal with the increasing pressure that they felt by the Medicare cuts was a reimbursement model of pay for performance or pay per visit. The overall objective of the pay per visit strategy is to serve more patients, provide more total visits, and thereby maintaining agency revenues without increasing total staffing costs. Pay-per-performance is basically a system of payment to home health care nurses and other service providers. It's not just nurses that are affected by this. Other home health care service health care providers are also affected by this. For achieving a specific production standard, this translates into pressure on home health care nurses to maintain a daily quota of patient visits. And arbitrarily allocating a specific predetermined charge per patient visit, and frequently an expected time limit for the length of that visit. And some of the nurses who are going to speak after me are going to talk about their own personal experiences with how this impacts their practice. Many nurses report that these time limits are unrealistic and inadequate and result in curtailed services to the patient. As a part of the implementation of the system, many agencies evaluate a nurse's productivity in home care based largely on the number of patient visits provided by the nurse, by a nurse per day. The current national healthcare visit staff productivity rate for nurses, this is a national figure, is 5.13 visits per day. The issues, both the agency evaluation system and the pay-per-visit compensation are problematic and serve to undermine the nurse's professional and independent judgment and practice and can result in curtailed patient care delivered by the nurse. Another criticism of the pay-per-visit or pay-for-performance model is the lack of allocated time needed to provide patient and family teaching, thorough patient assessments, psychosocial assessments, basic counseling. Remember, some of these patients are dying patients. This streamlining of home health care services translates into fewer and shorter visits to a particular patient during their illness episode, their 60-day illness episode. Many healthcare organizations administrations analyze pay-per-visit costs from cost savings perspectives without adequately and appropriately evaluating the impact of the system on quality of care. Nurse job satisfaction is a key issue here as we're facing a nurse shortage. And patient clinical outcomes, particularly impacted by these issues, is, as I said, the satisfaction of nurses with their jobs. Recent studies have found that major sources of job dissatisfaction for home health care nurses include feeling not respected and valued as an employee, a lack of control or autonomy in their decision-making, too much paperwork and documentation. These OASIS evaluations are very cumbersome in terms of the time and effort involved in making these OASIS assessments, and the nurses will speak specifically to that. Traditionally, home health care nursing practice effectiveness and patient satisfaction are based largely on a therapeutic relationship between the nurse and the patient, established with repeated, consistent, and long-term interactions. Pay-per-visit reimbursement systems have resulted in increased nurse workloads, increased job stress and pressure to meet minimum quotas, and resulting job dissatisfaction. Requiring a quota for patient visits per workday in home health care and hospice setting is indistinguishable from mandating staffing ratios in an acute care setting. It should be noted that pay-per-visit compensation is increasingly an inappropriate measure of productivity. because it doesn't include additional patient care-related tasks completed outside of the home, including coordinating services among agency providers. A lot of these patients need to have referrals to other providers for other kinds of treatment or services. Communicating with physicians or primary care providers. Referrals, as I said, and the piece of documentation, and documentation of is requires an extensive amount of time, particularly when we're talking about lengthy patient assessment protocols. One of the concerns that we have is that the pay-per-visit reimbursement financial system creates potential ethical issues in the delivery of nursing care to home health care patients. The model by nature creates a potential conflict of interest between the nurse's financial self-interest and the patient's welfare. The quality delivery of nursing care and job satisfaction in home health care and hospice setting is further undermined by pay-per-visit competition among nurses for desired low acuity patients that require less time and convenient visitation routes, which also require less time. They don't spend as much time driving and then therefore can increase the number of visits to increase individual wages. Higher levels of nurse staffing and allocation of nursing hours in the care of patients have been shown in acute care, and we, I think, can extrapolate these into home health care to better patient outcomes. Empirically, patient assessments and treatments such as hygiene maintenance, proper wound care, decubitide treatment, medication evaluation, and other environmental assessments, especially safety assessments for the patient, suffer when an insufficient number of nursing hours are allocated for patient care in the home setting. Allocation for nursing treatment and patient assessment in home care setting is best determined by the nurse who's in the setting, not by a quota. Or a supervisor unfamiliar with the nursing practice in the field and the specific patient care needs. Time allocated for completion of patient care delivery tasks, including oversight and coordination of patient care among professional and non-professional staff, as well as home caregivers, family members, or friends who may be involved in the care of the patient as well, is best determined by the registered nurse's professional clinical judgment. I want to thank you for your attention this morning and your thoughtful consideration.
Any questions? Thank you.
I'd have a quick question. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good to see you this morning.
Yeah. Just a question about the role of nurses. This is more of a legal question. Are nurses that we're talking about employees or are they contractors?
I think they're employees. They are employees of home health care agencies. Some of them are hospital-based home health care agencies. And the nurses who are currently employed by those agencies can speak to them.
Okay, and I'd like some clarification on the labor laws of hourly versus piecework and how all that works with an employee versus a contractor. I think that would be important.
Okay. We'll have to explore that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Next is Billy Lindros, Nancy McNath, and Robin Kaiser.
Mr. Chair and members of the I don't provide legal advice.
I'm a registered nurse from Eugene, Oregon. I am honored to be here and to be able to speak to you about this issue of pay for visit compensation for home health nurses. My background, I've been a registered nurse for about 30 years. I graduated from Lane Community College in Eugene. I'm currently a certified hospice nurse working for Sacred Heart Home Health Services in Eugene. Previous employment, I've been an intensive care unit nurse, a nurse recruiter, a home health nurse, and now a hospice nurse for about 3 years. I'm also an elected member of the Oregon Nurses Association Cabinet for Economic and General Welfare. I'd like to give you a little background on this issue and then talk about specifics. First of all, what do home health and hospice nurses do? We go out into the community and we see patients typically in their homes or in their facilities. We supply nursing assessment, coordination of care, instruction, and support to the patient and their families. We work with medical social workers, home health aides, physical therapists, occupational therapists, typically in the home health area. In hospice, we work with social workers, home health aides, chaplains. Our hospice agency also provides massage therapy to some patients. We have a Strings of Compassion program to provide music visuals for dying patients and their families. Who are our clients? Our clients are typically homebound or terminal patients. Home health patients are typically homebound, which means it's difficult for them to leave their home to access health care services. Hospice patients are terminal patients who their physician's best opinion is that they have 6 months or less to live. Our patients are often elderly, frail, financially challenged, and socially isolated. They're referred to us by their physicians for our assistance in helping to manage their home care needs, medical conditions, terminal conditions, and that type of stuff. Who pays for these services? There's a variety of payers: Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance. The agency I work for, which is nonprofit, also takes patients who have no means of reimbursement and provides services for them. How are the nurses currently compensated? Typically, home health and hospice nurses are hourly wage workers. They're covered. They're non-exempt employees, as I understand it, under labor law. We have benefits. We get paid by the hour. We're covered by the state labor regulations for hourly workers. Many of these nurses are represented by the Oregon Nurses Association. What's happening now? Well, what we're starting to see happen is that out-of-state for-profit agencies are coming into Oregon in an attempt to, what I consider to be, make a financial windfall off of our clients in this state. What do these for-profit agencies do? Well, they want to make a profit, and I understand that, but in order to do that and to maximize their profits, they have a number of strategies that they undertake, one of which is to restrict access to care based on the type of reimbursement. When a referral is called in from a physician's office, they're going to look and typically just take Medicare patients because there's a specific set of rules for Medicare patients. They don't want to get involved in Medicaid patients or private insurance patients, and they certainly don't want to take patients who have no means of reimbursement for their care. They also restrict access based on the type of diagnosis that the patient has. They want to take the simplest, quickest, cleanest cases that they can in order to not have to expend very much money on the care of this patient. And then the third thing they try to do is to drive down compensation to the staff, including nurses, primarily through pay-per-visit compensation schemes. Why should the legislature care? Well, there's three basic reasons, or three categories of reasons, in my opinion. First is that this will have a negative impact on the not-for-profit agencies. They'll be stuck taking the sickest, most complicated patients with the least favorable reimbursement. This will ultimately either drive them out of business or cause them to also try to slash wages for home health and hospice nurses and the other staff members with which we work. Also will have a severe negative impact on nurses. Pay per visit will make an already difficult job harder. It will force nurses to make difficult ethical choices between their patients' well-being and the nurses' financial well-being. It will not recognize the many tasks such as meeting, travel time, communication with physicians and family members that happen outside of the actual visit. And it also will foster unprofessional competition between nurses for the quickest, closest, and easiest visits to do. We call this cherry picking. It happens on both ends of the thing. It happens with the for-profit agencies that are quote-unquote cherry-picking the patients that they'll take, and then it ends up between nurses within a given agency fighting to end up with the easiest, quickest patients who live closest to the office to see. But the most important area of negative impact, I really think, is negative impact on the patients. It reduces the patients from human beings to a commodity. They're people. We're not bolting fenders on Toyotas. We're caring for people who are often old, very sick, have complicated problems, and need basic human kindness. I call what I do, my nursing that I do now, the practice of skilled kindness. The time we spend with them is invaluable to them and their families. Pay-per-visit will reduce the opportunities for coordination and support for this vulnerable population. It will ultimately result in denial of access to care for the sickest and most complicated patients. I'd like to discuss my work day yesterday and the issues I was dealing with one specific patient. I'm a hospice nurse. I have a patient who's in her 40s who's dying of cancer. She has a husband who's her primary caregiver at home. She has 5 children in their 20s. She has had cancer for 3 years. She had a long-term plan of accessing physician-assisted suicide at the end of her life, and things are going much more quickly than she or her doctors anticipated. Yesterday we were in a crisis situation. I got paged in the middle of the day that her pain was out of control. She was already on intravenous morphine at a relatively high dose. Prior to yesterday's visit, I have had extensive discussions with her and her husband, with our physicians. I spent time on the phone with one of the scientists in the Marines. He was in San Diego, getting ready to get deployed for a second tour of duty in Iraq. I spent time on the phone with a Navy doctor discussing his mother's condition, with the American Red Cross to arrange for him to be transported home rather than going to Iraq so he could be with his mom in the last days of her life. We had a pain crisis yesterday. I spent time getting a hold of our hospice medical director, talking to a pharmacist to arrange for a second intravenous infusion of a very potent tranquilizing type medication in the home because her pain was out of control. She was having terminal restlessness, could not stay still, could not stay in bed, was climbing out of bed. Her fam, and she wanted to be at home. She did not want to be in the hospital for the last days of her life. This was a clearly stated goal of her. So a lot of work, not only as a visit, but in the office, on the phone, arranging all of this stuff, getting a hold of the on-call nurse yesterday evening, and a home infusion nurse as well to go back out to the home to start the second IV infusion. That all took a lot of time, and that's really important to the family. But I think what's even more significant for this patient and family is the time I spent talking with them ahead of time. So I was very clear on what her wishes were and what her family's wishes were, and was able to help guide them and help guide the physicians and other team members into what was going to meet her goals and her needs at this point in time. I would just hate to be working under a situation where I would have to feel like I couldn't do that stuff to the patient's best interest and the family's best interest. And that's the reason why I'm really concerned about pay-per-visit compensation schemes. I think we have to treat our patients with dignity and respect, and we have to work to solve their problems and meet their goals. And that's time-consuming and can't be reduced to a mathematical formula. So thank you for your attention to this matter.
Ma'am, before you start, I just wanted to apologize to everyone for my being so late. I was stuck on 205, but I had a lovely drive through Morala, Moreno, and Woodburn on the way here. But so, just go ahead. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad to be here to address an issue that's very close to my heart and very involved in what I do every day. My name is Robin Kaiser, and I've been a nurse for 30 years as well. And for the last 14 years, I've been employed as a mental health, home health nurse at the same agency. And during that time, I have had 4 different employers. As initially, I was with a non-profit, sold to a for-profit, and bought out by another for-profit. And I'm currently working for Amedisys, which is a very large
for-profit.
Home health agency centered in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
We were bought out by them in September of this year, of last year. And since Amedisys has come to control our agency, there have been a lot of changes. One major thing is that most of their agencies employ a home pay-per-visit model. The physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists, social workers, home health aides have all already gone to this model. The only reason the nurses haven't is because we have the ONA behind us, and we're in negotiations trying to prevent this from happening. So there's a reprieve right now. But since the therapists and everyone has already gone to it, we have a real sense of how it works for them and how it doesn't work for them. There have been three physical therapists that I know of that have quit since this model came into effect last month. So they're not particularly happy with it. The way it works is basically there's a base pay that each therapist gets or each nurse gets based on their experience and their how long they've been with the company as well, apparently. And so they have the base pay based on experience, and they're different compensation for weekends and after hours. Those visits are reimbursed at a higher rate, so there is some payback there. Travel time is included with the visit, so however long it takes you to get to the patient's house is included in the price of the visit, no matter whether it takes you 10 minutes or it takes you 40 minutes, which is hard for those of us that work in rural areas, and it frequently takes me 30 to 40 minutes to get to a patient's house from one patient to another. As a mental health nurse, I have particular concerns. One is that the patients that I see are usually elderly, frail elderly, homebound patients with dementia or depression. I'm the person they call in if somebody has a behavior problem in a facility or an adult foster home or something, and they want to figure out what to do with this patient and how to make their behavior more manageable. Needless to say, these aren't quick visits. Our agency has said that a typical visit should be about 30 minutes. Well, most of my visits take about 50 minutes, typically, and that's without travel time. Travel time is separate. So this isn't really going to work for me, and it doesn't work for me. I spend a lot of time communicating with family members, communicating with caregivers, doing behavioral management intervention strategies with caregivers. Like, why is this problem? Studying the problem behavior and why is this occurring, what can we do to intervene and prevent this from happening. Also, medication titration is something that I do. We have to get a lot of these patients on medication, and then I have to go back and see how exactly is this working, which also involves reviewing charts at facilities and seeing, okay, what time of the day was a person acting out? What time of the day was this a problem? Are they sleeping through the night? So it usually involves going to the records at the facility. So that takes some time. In general, the patients that we see are much sicker than they used to be. They're, because of the hospital reimbursement issues, there's a real push to get the patients out of the hospital and at home. A lot of times they're discharged too soon, and we go out there and we have to send them back to the hospital. And that takes a lot of time. There's a lot of coordination that's involved in arranging a hospital admission. A couple weeks ago, I had to send a lady back to the hospital. She'd been sent out too quick and was off her medications, and her behavior was totally out of control. I had to call the daughter in California and get her okay to send the patient to the hospital. I had to call the physician and get it okay from him. I had to call the emergency room to arrange the admission. And I had to call the ambulance service and arrange for them to come. And then I had to wait for the ambulance to get there because the lady was in no shape to communicate what her needs were to the EMTs who arrived to take her to the hospital. So all that took about an hour and a half, which was a much longer visit than usual. And that kind of thing happens to us on a, well, not a, maybe not a daily basis, but probably a weekly basis. You might have a visit like that that takes quite a bit of time. Also, my role as a case manager is not addressed adequately in the pay-per-visit system. As a case manager, on a day-to-day basis, I have to coordinate with family members and others, healthcare professionals, doctors, therapists, in order to provide the quality of care that the patient needs. There's a lot of phone calls that have to be made, and those are not typically reimbursed under the pay-per-visit system. I have a lot of dementia patients who have care, well, they have adult children who are out of town, so I have to communicate with them, and sometimes those are very long conversations. Communication is a very important part of what I do, and I don't feel that the paper visit system will compensate me for that part. In general, my objection to paper visit is that it rewards a nurse monetarily for quantity, not quality. And the phrase piecework came up earlier, and I think that's a good description of what this is. And it just doesn't work with human beings. I went into nursing because I wanted to help people, and I wanted to be able to provide quality care and feel good about the job that I'm doing. And I like home care because I'm able to do that. I'm able to go into the patient's home and really look at the whole picture and see what's important to them. And not just put a Band-Aid on the situation, but in terms of just looking at the whole global picture and trying to figure out what I can do. I feel like our patients need more dignity and respect than this. They don't need to be treated like in the analogy of the car assembly line. That's not the way healthcare works, and I'd like to prevent that from happening in Oregon. And that's why I'm here, and I really appreciate your consideration of this issue, and I would hope that you really consider the patients foremost in your consideration of the issue. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
President Cameron.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, all three of you, for being here today and having experienced, as a family member, the need to have somebody come in with my mom when she was having cancer. I really appreciate what you do. It's very unique and takes special gifts to do it. So thanks for coming and sharing with us today and what you do. Questions for you. I need to get clarified on, we talked about reimbursement and that there's an hourly base rate and then a pay per visit bonus or however quota. And Robin, in your testimony you talked about the quota or the time that they've allocated is about a 30-minute time.
They told us, yeah.
A time frame. You said it takes you about an average of 50 minutes. You had said that it took you 30, 40 minutes to drive to a place, and that is included in the time. So I just want to get my mind around, if it takes you 50 minutes with a patient and it takes you 30 to 40 minutes to drive average because you're in a rural area, so are we talking about 80 to 90 minutes is what it takes you?
Right.
And you said that your drive time is included in their 30 minutes. So are we really talking about...
Drive time, no. When they said 30 minutes, I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. When they told us a typical visit was 30 minutes, they meant the patient time.
Okay.
They weren't including the drive time. They were saying, because what somebody specifically asked when they came to talk to us is how long should a visit take, and they said, well, you should be about 30 minutes in the home. So that's not including the drive time. So my 50 minutes in the home, as opposed to their 30 minutes in the home, to do a mental health visit.
Okay.
Irregardless of the drive time.
Okay, so we're talking 30 versus 50 minutes,
right,
in your mind. Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess that helps clarify what I...
While we open this up for questions,
I have one more question. Are there home health care companies, organizations in Oregon that are not moving towards the pay by visit? Is there nurses that are working for companies that...
I think actually currently most home health nurses and hospice nurses are hourly employees. We see this as a new trend that's starting, and that's why we're raising this issue.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative. And maybe this will be clarified, and maybe it already has. Once again, I'm sorry I'm late, but... And I'm sorry about this feedback, too. It's driving me crazy. I know we're working on it. But do you work under a collective bargaining agreement, you personally? Or explain to me how you're... And in that agreement, did you negotiate with these in the past? And I hope we hear from the providers in industry to hear another... I want to hear all sides today. I request that we do that. But are you under a collective bargaining agreement currently?
that's an interesting question, because we've been negotiating a contract for the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. The new company came in September, and the company that I'm with, actually, to give you a little history, I was originally employed by the Legacy Visiting Nurses Association. The Visiting Nurses Association was the first home health care agency in Oregon, and it started about 1904. And then Legacy bought it in the 80s, and then Legacy sold it to the first for-profit in 2005. For the last 20 years or so, ONA has represented our agency. And each time we've been bought out by a new employer, we've negotiated a new contract. And we're currently negotiating that. And that's why we have not a paper visit. All the therapists and the physical therapists, the occupational therapists, the social workers, speech therapists, and the home health aides are already being paid in the paper visit model. And the only reason we haven't is because we're negotiating the contract right now.
Okay, then in your former or existing contract, whichever it is.
Yeah, we're kind of in limbo right now.
Okay, yeah, so the contract is expired, is that correct? Or you're under a contract currently?
We're actually...
That's a tricky question. We're getting close.
We're getting close.
The papers aren't signed yet. We're without a contract.
Okay, all right. In the old contract, does it clearly speak to drive time and all the time that you use doing your duties outside of the patient's home? And does it address specifically the time you're allotted and need to be reimbursed for inside the home? How does this work?
Well, we were paid hourly before.
Okay.
Paid hourly.
All right.
And there were certain productivity expectations that you would have to meet, and I, for one, always met them. You were supposed to see 5 patients a day. And I always did that. So basically, this is a big change in the way they do things.
Thank you. Go ahead, Nim.
My name is Nancy McNatt, and I, too, want to thank you today for your attention to this subject. I'm a registered nurse and case manager. I work for Amedisys, the same company that Robin works for, and that's a company that moved into Oregon last September of 2007. I've been a nurse for 20 years, and I just now have a Master's of Science degree from NHSU in advanced practice life. I have been employed in home health for 11 years, and originally the organization that employed me was Legacy Visiting Nurses Association. That was in place until about 2¾ years ago when it was sold to a for-profit business, and since then we've been through 3 subsequent for-profit businesses, so we've had 4 different employers in less than 3 years, each with their own changes. With Amedisys, we had the introduction of the pay-per-visit possibility, because that is the system that they use in the other 45 states where they are presently working. Fortunately, we did have this pre-existing affiliation with the Oregon Nurses Association, and were able to start work on the contract. We recognized that we had this contract previously, probably in about October, so a month after they came in, and we began work, and we're in the process of finalizing that contract at this time. And that will give us a little kind of temporary stay from the pay-per-visit idea, at least until the contract is reopenable next spring, when it will once again be open. The other people in our organization, physical therapists, social workers, home health aides, have gone to pay-per-visit as of about a month ago, and their resignation rate has, of course, been extremely high. There's been a lot of dissatisfaction with this visit, with this idea. It's because what you're compensating for here is speed. So if you can get out there and deliver health care in a speedy way, you can profit and make money with such a system. If you are interested in the quality of the care, you really cannot make a living at it to the extent that we are presently making a living as nurses in this state. It is like piecework. It's along the lines of Domino's pizza delivery. You know, you want to drive fast, get in fast, get out fast, etc. That's what's been promoted. So
I am a case manager, and I looked at my caseload last night and divided my patients into kind of categories, groups, and I came up with five basic groups of patients that I'm presently seeing. Number one would be the chronically ill. This includes elderly people who are disabled, people who are morbidly obese, they can't easily leave their homes. They require ongoing skilled assessment. They have catheters, feeding tubes, chronic wounds, stasis wounds, pressure sores. Some require an ambulance just to get into the doctor's office. Visiting a doctor is something that they don't do very often. We have two people who are problematic. They require home visits to determine what's going on within their own personal living situation. Are they receiving inadequate care from caregivers? Do they have underlying mental health problems? Perhaps they're turning up over and over again at the emergency room with problems that have already been addressed and they're not following the guidelines to treat their problems. Are they failing to show up at their doctor's appointments? And sometimes when they do show up for appointments or at the emergency room, their hygiene is appalling, and the question is what's going on in this person's home environment. Also, managing medications. Medications are problematic insofar as people take many, many different prescription drugs. I've had patients prescribed as many as 30 different drugs with different prescription writers, different pharmacies providing the medicine. Sometimes they're taking medicines that are outdated, belong to other family members. People can bring forth bags or bottles when you visit their homes. The third group, I would call new acute diagnoses that require an assessment of their needs and kind of a plan for the navigation of what they're having to deal with. This could be a severe kind of cancer situation, a new diabetic, especially insulin-dependent diabetics who have to manage their care alone in their homes, people with autoimmune diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, AIDS, lupus, etc. Category 4, large surgeries, people who would have to expend too much effort to get out to their first surgery appointment for a checkup. Sometimes the surgery appointments are as far as a month. The appointments with the surgeon is as far as a month after the surgery. So in other words, they go 4 weeks without being seen by their surgeon. We go out, check the incisions, do blood work, and communicate, you know, what is going on. It's going to be cardiac bypasses, various types of new ostomies, organ transplants, infected wounds that need to heal in an open state from inside out, total joint patients. And number 5, the terminally ill people who have decided to not go with hospice care, but rather they don't want to make a commitment to hospice. Sometimes they do in the very final days of their life, but before that there can be a lot of time when they have many, many needs. So, you know, these are complex people. None of them benefit from speed. They all require time and compassion and organization, communication with the people that are also providing care for them. There's just nothing speedy about home health. And their lives depend on receiving this kind of care, their ability to stay at home. In the past, many people have been cared for in the hospital or in nursing homes, and presently they are living on their own or with family members taking care of them. So a medicine had mailed out some stock information last week as our employer, and the front cover stated that their revenue is up 29% and their net income is up 70%. Their other offices in the United States are all pay-per-visit offices. And here in Portland, we've been lucky because in our office, our small group of nurses has been able to hold its ground with the ONA, with one of the ONA contracts.
Forgive me, ma'am, I want to clarify one thing. Net revenue of the business is up 29%. Whose pay is up 70%?
Whose what?
You said someone's pay, income is up.
Revenue. This is what
the company in jet. The company's in.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just like these two bullets on the front cover. And Amedisys limits its insurance referrals. They take Medicare. They take some Blue Cross Med Advantage patients, and they take people who are veteran pay patients. Other than that, they're not taking other managed care plans. They're not taking Medicaid or Oregon Health Plan at this time. So they have come into the state, and they are attempting to take the, you know, cream off the top, right? So, anyway, home health is very important.
If I may again, I'm sorry, I just need to clarify this because I'm not on a health care committee and I'm grateful for that, especially in light of what I've heard, been hearing this morning. The cream off the top, the Medicare, those are the patients that have resources and are capable of paying relative to those who don't. Is that what you're
better.
That's what you're referring to?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The reimbursements are better.
Representative Esquel?
I'm curious. There's one thing, and I'm sorry I had to go outside for a little bit, but maybe this was brought up. It was stated that we had 5.31 visits nationwide. Why is this change here in Oregon? Are we like three visits, or what's the deal here? Is it just motivated by a business that's the way they run their business elsewhere? I mean, what is the quota? We're talking about a quota. What is it? Eight a day?
The average is five a day. I think nationwide is the average.
5.31 was stated,
yeah.
Visits per day. What is the quota that these people are putting? You said that it's a pay-per-visit and a quota.
Uh-huh.
How many visits a day are we talking about?
They're wanting 5 points a day, and points are figured up in different ways depending on whether they're what's called weighted visits. Weighted visits are OASIS visits, as Susan was describing. Registered nurses make OASIS visits. There's more paperwork, there's more assessment. It's an overwhelming amount of assessment. So I think that the confusion here is between productivity versus pay per visit, right? I mean, we're talking about productivity of 5 or 5.3 patients a day, and the organizations are talking about pay per visit, which is where a nurse gets paid per visit. So they're two separate things.
We're talking about quota too.
Talking about pay per visit.
I mean, well, we brought up quota here.
You would have.
What is the quota? That's my question.
I think the term guideline might be a better term.
Okay.
Than a quota.
That's different.
A goal or a guideline under where you're paid by the hour. You have basic goals, but it's understood that you don't meet those some of the time. And oftentimes you don't because of the complexity of given patients, the distance from the office, and those type of factors. So the employer tends to look at those things, and that it's not a quota so much as a guideline.
Okay. Because I was thinking, when you mention quota, that means every day you will see X amount of... You will make X amount of visits. That to me is a quota.
Okay, we don't have to. Did you? Anyone else?
I'm for this panel.
We have to be out of here at 12:30, and we have a lot of mail here. But before you go, I too want to thank you. My mother has had in-home health nurses come, and my brother Arnie, God bless him, and his wife Penny have taken on this responsibility. She's in a foster care home, but they have invested a lot of their time and money and taking care of my mom, and we're all grateful for that. But the stress put on families. My brother in Webster City, Iowa, where I grew up, Pat, he tried to take care of me and couldn't. My sister in Chicago tried to and couldn't. And then now Arnie flew out here, and she's in Beaverton. And sometimes I fill in when he's not around. So I just want to thank you for what you're doing. And this state's aging. I think we're the fourth oldest state in the country. I read in the paper yesterday, I think, and we're getting older. So this issue is not going to go away. I am not on the healthcare committees, and I don't ever want to be on a healthcare committee, to be quite frank with you. I'd rather easy issues like business and labor. But I do want, my wife is a dentist, Dr. Frances Sinceri, for that winning smile. I feel like Alan Brown schlepping the Les Schwab tires here. But anyway, my good friend Alan Brown, I might add, she worked for a large dental firm when she came out of dental school, which I won't say right now, and it was go, go, go. And she has her own practice a year after she got out of school, went to work for that firm, got her own practice, and she provides the most highest quality care of dental care in the world, and employs 7 people, all women, and she's very generous to them, and they just don't get in a hurry up there. And I that being said, she has to make money too, and I want all businesses to make money, and I thank the businesses, the people that want to be in this business, I want to thank them too. I want to hear from them today, Sarah, if that's okay, right after this panel and your colleague there. But I hope the negotiations go well. That would be my goal, that you negotiate a contract outside of this building, avoiding any legislation, if that can happen. If it doesn't, and we need to go down the road of making sure that people are getting reimbursed properly, and when you say the word piecework, that hits a nerve in me right like that as a laborer. But that would be my first desire and wish, and I think most of the, if not everyone up here, would share that. But if we go down this road of legislation, which I'm not afraid to do either, I definitely want to get everyone in the same room, the industry and the laborers, the nurses, and talk this all out and see if we can get something we could all agree on, we could all benefit from, and make sure we're providing the health care that the people of Oregon need and deserve, and make sure the workers get reimbursed properly and aren't working for nothing. I don't want anyone working for nothing in Oregon. Is there any further questions for this panel? Because I think Representative Holden.
Not so much a question, thank you, Mr. Chair, but just a comment. I too, since everybody shared, have had a lot of experience 4 times with home health and hospice for relatives of mine, and I just can't imagine how piecework would really fit this industry, where it would take a half a day sometimes of having that hospice nurse there when times were very critical, when somebody was close to death, and sometimes maybe they can pop in for half an hour. But that, you know, there's just too hard to have any equity in pay with a piecework as such in that kind of industry. I'm not sure what industry really does work with piecework, but maybe picking beans, but definitely not in healthcare, I don't think.
Great.
So, thank you.
Anything else? Gentlemen, okay, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming in today. Sarah Myers, would you please come up and respond to some of this and give us your side of this, please?
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sarah Myers. I'm the Executive Director to the Oregon Association for Home Care. Thank you for having us here today. I would like to thank Ms. Van Winkle for notifying me that this was an issue being considered. Until 2 weeks ago, we were unaware that this was something that was brewing. And I also very much want to appreciate the testimony today from the nurses in the audience, because certainly without nurses and therapists and clinicians of their caliber, we could not do what we do for patients every day in Oregon. The pay-per-visit methodology is a common practice that is utilized nationally by home health agencies. And as Representative Cameron questioned, the United States Department of Labor has clearly articulated its position relative to pay per visit with registered nurses, and its position has been unchanged on that since 1971. There is both case law and data supporting the practice of pay per visit in the home health setting. In Oregon, the practice is utilized by some home health agencies, both in a purely pay-per-visit practice as well as in conjunction with hourly pay, dependent upon whether a clinician may be delivering services to a patient in their home or perhaps maybe back in the office doing documentation. due to widespread workforce shortages that have been referenced already, both nurses and therapists, and increased costs in recruitment and retention of these types of clinicians, the pay-per-visit model is another method by which home health agencies have more discretion in terms of attracting new clinicians to the field of home care. Quality home health care services really truly are the hallmark of home health agencies all across Oregon. It's important to note that there are multiple checks in the system that render tying the per-visit pay issue to quality of care speculative at best. Oregon providers lead the nation in providing high-quality patient outcomes with a low number of visits. Nurses in Oregon, as you may know, are licensed by the Oregon State Board of Nursing and subject to professional quality standards of practice. Under the Medicare conditions of participation, home health agencies are surveyed regularly, and this includes many aspects scrutinizing the quality of care for patients. There is also a national tool called the Home Health Compare, and it also measures an agency and clinician's quality of care performance on multiple care delivery measures, primarily for the purpose of accountability to the public. And most home health agencies are also voluntarily accredited, providing for additional high-level quality standards to be met in order to maintain and keep this accreditation. There is also a comprehensive patient complaint process affording recipients of home health care services an opportunity to comment and appeal care delivered by an agency in Oregon through our state's quality improvement organization. I know of no such study, either national or otherwise, that links any compromising quality of care issues to pay-per-visit practices. Further, home health agencies are subject to a prospective payment system, a method by which Medicare pays for home health services delivered to patients, with which one of our ONA representatives had previously mentioned. This limited fixed payment for services means that poor quality of care will lead to the need for more visits, therefore increasing the cost, rather, to home health agencies more beyond what the payment provided by Medicare may be. Another disincentive to poor quality care is evident under the managed care model, which Oregon has quite a history in. Managed care is not tolerant of poor quality, again, because it leads to greater costs in care. So there are, as I've stated, many checks and balances in the system for providing for the quality of care measurements in the home health setting. Oregon's home health agency providers are number one in the country for high-quality, cost-effective service delivery, and we pride ourselves on that. Decreasing high-quality patient care is not in the patient's best interest, nor the agency, nor the industry at large. Finally, there is no empirical data whatsoever tying quality of care to pay per visit, and to assert otherwise is unfounded. And we appreciate very much the opportunity to address this issue and certainly be happy to answer any questions. But before I do, maybe my colleague Michelle Lane from Marquis Home Health Services could address some of the issues that have, and questions that have been raised by the committee.
Yeah, please.
Thank you.
Not having much time to prepare, really.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Say what?
You have to identify yourself
I'm
for the record.
Thank you. Not having a lot of time and knowing what was coming up, just kind of made some bullets regarding comments that I heard earlier. And being an administrator for an agency on the provider side, also being a nurse myself. One of the issues brought up was the productivity quotas or guidelines, as was later stated. Whether my agency used to be hourly, and then we went to pay per visit about a year and a half ago, hourly and pay per visit, we both had guidelines or expectations of the staff for either length of visit or number of visits to be done in a day. If you've got one staff member performing one visit in a day and making the same amount of money as someone performing four visits in a day, the agency can't financially survive in that type of situation. So that's why I believe every agency has a type of productivity percentage that they like their clinicians to achieve. The paper visit that we made our rates based on was a national average of the visit times, which I believe the latest national average I know of is 48 minutes per visit. We took that, we added in an average amount of travel time that we see in our areas, and we service, my office services, from Woodburn down to Cresswell, and then probably 15, 20 minutes east or west of I-5. So we have a lot of rural patients. Our average drive time per patient is about 22 minutes. So we average that time in with the visit, and then included documentation time as well. So we took all of the components and averaged it in with the visit. What we've seen with our clinicians is there has been a decrease in time per visit. It's actually been an increase of 4 minutes per visit per patient since we went to pay per visit from hourly. Our quality of patient outcomes has not changed. We just completed a state survey 2 weeks ago, which, as Sarah mentioned, is quite comprehensive. And the average number of deficiencies for an agency is 6. We received 2, meaning the care that we provide is excellent. Patients are taken care of. And then our staff, the staff that work hourly and now work pay per visit, had talked with them before coming in, and they prefer the pay-per-visit pay. They actually say that there's not much difference, period, between pay-per-visit and hourly, as far as they see with what they're allowed to do with patients and how their paychecks look at the end of the month. So I think that, you know, that's kind of what I took from the testimony before. To me, what it sounds like, you know, speaking as a nurse, and not as an administrator or provider, is that it's an employer issue and not really a legislative issue. Possibly the things, you know, I've heard regarding this employer, this business that has come to town, you know, me as a nurse, I don't think I would want to work in that position if that is indeed what they're going to do. But there are many providers out there that do pay for visit and do take into account and allow for hourly pay if there's an extra 2 hours spent with a patient. We pay hourly for time that's spent in the office doing extra coordination of care. And I know at least in the Salem area that there are other agencies that do the same thing. So
I have a question.
Just a second. I want to thank Teresa Van Winkle, my most able committee administrator as well. She has bailed me out of countless problems, and we could not run as effective and efficient a committee as we have in the last year and a half without her. I just wanted to say that, and if there's any responsibility as to the timing of this or any surprise, I bear complete responsibility for that, Sarah. I think, though, historically you'll find me as a legislator and me as a chair and this committee, and specifically this committee, have went out of our way to be fair to labor and business, and we're going to continue to do that. I can assure you we are not going to roll any industry. Quite frankly, you, God bless the home healthcare agencies. I would rather dig dirt on a hot summer day than run one of those, or be quite frank, if you'd be a nurse. I honestly believe the vast majority of people in this industry aren't doing it to become gazillionaires. You have to be passionate about your work and love helping people, or you wouldn't do it. I just wanted to share. I wanted to share that with you because I apologize to anyone that was surprised. I bear the complete responsibility for that. But that being said, I believe it is an employer labor issue. I've already made it clear. I would love to see this solved at the bargaining table, but I am not above supporting some kind of legislation if it cannot happen to make sure that people are provided with the best care we can provide them with and people get paid for the work they're doing. And I want people to make money too, obviously. It's American. I'm a capitalist. So do you currently, Michelle, work under a collective bargaining agreement at your business?
No.
Okay. Have you ever? You yourself personally? Okay. All right, Kevin, Representative Cameron, I believe I saw your hand go up, and then Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just asked one of the questions, which is the collective bargaining, so people are at will in your organization.
Right.
And the second question, the first question I had, you briefly mentioned 48 minutes you use for the visit, 22 minutes average drive time, and you said you have some documentation time. How much do you have in there?
12 minutes. A lot of the documentation is performed in the home. We're on laptops, so they're able to, and even on paper you could as well, but a lot of the documentation is performed in the home while you're doing the visit to help ensure accuracy, so you don't wait until 2 hours later to try and write down a finding that you found during your assessment.
So that's 60 minutes in the visit and 22 minutes drive time.
Right.
Okay.
I have a bigger issue here, I guess. Well, I want to ask a question. How hard is it for you right now to find the people to do this job?
For my agency personally, we do not have as much difficulty finding nurses, therapists, as other agencies do. We most of the staff that we do get is from word of mouth from our existing employees. They love working for our company. They enjoy their jobs. And we as a company believe that if you keep your employees happy, then that in turn keeps your clients or patients happy and everybody's happy.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Happy, that's good. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sarah Michelle, thanks for coming and testifying. Both of you said a couple of things that I wanted to follow up on with some follow-up questions. Sarah, you made the point that pay-per-view would give the agencies, the employers, discretion to attract employees with, or the discretion and some more tools to help attract more employees. So is it the assertion that by being able to say, well, if you work more quickly, then you're going to make more money, and therefore you're going to be able to attract more. I mean, I'm trying to dig into that statement a little bit more.
Before you answer, I think the good representative meant pay per visit.
Not pay per view.
Sorry.
Yeah. We had a joke.
Definitely pay per visit.
I knew you did, representative.
Pay for in the world today. There's pay for performance, there's prospective pay, there's pay for visits. All of these pay pers get a little confusing, so I can appreciate that. Relative to the question about discretion, as a national practice, the pay for visit methodology, again, has been used and utilized for many, many years by agencies all across the country. And in terms of providing additional flexibility to nurses who may only want to work part time or who have children who need to escort them to and from school, the pay per visit methodology allows them that flexibility to work within the parameters and understanding with the guidance, as Michelle has indicated, that they have relative to productivity. It just provides more flexibility.
So, Paul?
Yeah, please go ahead.
So, part of what I'm trying to understand is, would it be the assertion then of the agencies that you have a certain number of employees that they're mixing responsibilities, their home responsibilities and their job responsibilities throughout the day, and you said flexibility for part-time, for instance, you know, for part-time workers, I mean, you could just pay them for 3 hours of work. You can still do part-time on an hourly basis, can't you?
That was certainly just a for example in terms of how the paperless methodology is working with some agencies, but certainly let Michelle step in since her nurses are working under the methodology directly.
I believe when I spoke before, a reference to when I talked about productivity. If everybody's hourly and two nurses both work 8 hours in the day, they both get paid their 8 hours at an hourly rate. If you've got one nurse that is more efficient, not quick and doing poor quality care, but more efficient and able to get her work done, and you've got another nurse that is slower and takes maybe 2-3 times longer, they get the same type of work done, it just takes longer. The nurse that's working 8 hours and seeing 4 patients makes the same amount of money in an hourly world as the nurse that is seeing 1 patient in an 8-hour day. So for some of the nurses, and we're speaking of nurses, not the rest of the disciplines, but for the nurses, it is appealing to them because they like being paid for the work that they're doing. And if they're able to get the 4 visits or 5 visits done in a day, then they appreciate being paid that amount of money for those visits. Did that answer?
Representative Holby, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here and testifying. I'm looking at this issue, and I'm having just a little bit of trouble understanding, this pay-per-visit issue. And it's, you know, I wanted to also mention that there's more people involved in this than just the employer and the employee. There's the patient that has a a big stake in this and perhaps some rights as well to having quality care. And it seems to me that if you're on a pay-per-visit setup, that there's an incentive for the nurse to get done and move on to the next patient. And there's a wide range of patient needs out there, and you know, at different times patients may need more care than others. And so how would you possibly ensure that you're delivering the quality care that a patient needs when in fact you've got an economic incentive for the nurse to move on to another patient? I mean, to me that just doesn't fit. It seems to me that we're a pay-per-visit scenario in this kind of industry really puts the patient at risk of not getting the type of care they need. You know, I tell you, I've seen this happen in front of my eyes where a hospice patient needs more attention on a particular day. And if that nurse goes, oh, I really have to move on because, you know, I got bills to pay, and if I don't make five visits today, you know, I'm not going to be able to pay my rent. And so, you know, maybe you can give the shot, and I'm going to move on. And it just seems to me that this is not a good industry to have this kind of system of pay in. And I just don't know how do you ensure that you're going to make the patient's going to get the quality of care when they need it?
First, I'm just speaking to home health, not to hospice. If it was hospice, I'm not sure if we would do a pay-per-visit. I also have had a personal experience with my mother in hospice 11 years ago. So just speaking to home health, when you have clinicians that are working out in the field anyway, outside of your eyesight, you hire staff that you believe are moral, ethical, and trustworthy. Whether it's pay-per-visit or hourly, there's the chance that the care could not be given if they're on an hourly pay. They could just as easy go in and do a 15-minute visit and go hang out at Starbucks for 45 minutes and count that in the visit. So pay-per-visit or hourly, either there isn't a lot of physical oversight of the person because they're outside and in the community. What we look at is we review their charts, we review the patient visits, we look at the quality outcomes that CMS provides, as Sarah stated. We depend on survey. We depend on patient satisfaction surveys. Our agency is at a 98% satisfaction for all of our patients for the 15 questions that we ask on our survey. So those are things we look at. Pay-per-visit potentially could be an incentive for an ethical staff member to go out and try and make more money. And that's just something I believe that the administration of the agency has to watch for, and it's the administration's responsibility to make sure that we have ethical, moral employees and they're doing what they're supposed to be doing.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, once again, that's why I spent quite a bit of time in my testimony emphasizing the quality checks and balances that are currently in place for the nurse under his or her license, under Medicare that requires each agency to perform up to certain quality standards relative to the services they provide all their patients, regardless of payer. As a Medicare-certified agency, they're required to provide services under what are called conditions of participation. And any breach in that could cause them to lose that certification, regardless of who's paying, whether it's private pay, Medicaid, or otherwise. In addition, there are home health compare, which are public standards in terms of reporting quality of care for patients. And again, there is that patient opportunity, as you indicated. There is a right to quality care, and they have the opportunity and ability to work with our state quality improvement organization, which is a completely independent body, contacted by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to ensure that quality services are being provided to patients in the home health setting.
Mr. Chair. Just a real quick question. Michelle, you mentioned about the quality surveys that you do. You talked about your agency. Do I also, as a employee, do I get measured by my scores?
At this time, no, we are not. Across the nation, there are several agencies with pay-for-performance coming from CMS that are looking at implementing some type of incentive performance-based bonus program for their employees, which would be on top of their regular salary. But we at this time do not, something that we'll look into in the future, but not at this time.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as I've listened to the questions and whatnot, I'm still struggling with seeing what the clear advantages are for the agencies under pay-per-visit. There are clear advantages under pay-per-view, like you don't have to drive to the video store.
That's
true. It's more convenient, right, on your TV. That's for another hearing. So I guess, I mean, I want to make it clear on the record that I share a lot of the concerns expressed by Representative Holvey and some other folks about the quality of care. I'm hearing conflicting information about, I mean, Michelle testified that under a pay-per-visit, their actual time per patient went up. So, you know, that seems to be, we seem to have some conflicting information about what might happen versus what has happened. I don't think, I mean, I think if we're to get real about this, and I'm not on the healthcare committee, and I share many of the sentiments of our good chair about that, but I mean, it seems to me that you guys are probably all on the same page when it comes to caring about the work that you do. The agencies need to make a profit. If they're not making a profit, we don't have people, or we don't have the agencies to be able to deliver these critical services to our society. We're probably all on the same page in wanting higher reimbursement rates. And a lot of this, when we get into a room like this and we get into these political discussions, comes down to who's going to dig in the hardest and draw the line as to whose pocket it's going to come out of. And my primary concern is going to come down on the side of the patients in this case, recognizing that we are all in this together, and it's not, I mean, what's clearly a win for somebody is not necessarily a win for everybody in all cases. So I just wanted to get that on the record, and I have some concerns with pay-per-visit.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions before we move on, folks? Yeah, like I said earlier, I honestly believe, I don't think there are a lot of nurses out there, whether they're getting paid per visit or by the hour, they're going to go out and hang out at Starbucks or wherever. I have hope, and I believe, and I have faith that that's not going on, regardless of what direction the state goes in this. But I am grateful we brought this to our attention, because I think this is a labor employer issue, and it's just added on that extra layer of it's a very human issue too, which makes it very complex and difficult and emotional. So I really want to, once again, I'm sorry this has been thrust upon you. I take full responsibility, but I would like this conversation to continue going on. And I'll just leave us with this. As a laborer and a labor's union, I remember my foreman saying, happy workers make happy products. You know, and if you take care of your workforce, they will take care of the production and the quality of that work, regardless of what you're doing. And I'm not suggesting people are out there trying to maliciously not take care of their workforce. But I want this conversation to continue, and I think it will, and I hope we could come to some resolve outside of this building. That would be everyone's first number one goal. Would be great. If in light of after all this, if there is any language, specific language, which we're not talking about today, we're all going to be sitting down talking about this over and over and over again before anything gets moved. I can promise you that. So, unless you have anything else, we're going to move on. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming today. So, we didn't have any hearing or anything.
It's an informational hearing, so you have to gavel in for the hearing.
I don't need to bring the gavel of us to move on to the other topic, right? Okay, very good. Well, next we're going to jump to the state of the industry, and Representative Cameron, I'm grateful he brought this concept up, because especially in, I mean, today I think there's a revenue forecast. Is it today?
Yes.
Yeah, so we're very interested in the state of the industry in this committee, obviously. So I'm just going to, and I want to thank Representative Cameron for bringing this up, because I think it's very timely and obviously germane to this committee. So I'm going to start off with Mr. Bill Perry. You want to come on up here, Bill, and tell us your side of this? Morning.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry, and with the Oregon Restaurant Association, we have four pages of testimony coming around that I'm not going to read, obviously, some support material for each council review and opinion. I do appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I would say, from an industry perspective, and I'm sure I'll get corrected by Representative Cameron if I speak out of line for the industry and all, but our industry is probably a little bit more optimistic than others. At the beginning of the year, we as a state probably had a higher employment growth than most states projected, and we had a higher revenue than most states projected. We're between about 4.5% to 5% on both revenue growth and employment growth. Now, that came at the beginning of the year, and I drove my testimony into kind of three different sections. One was food costs, one was immigration, one was immigration, because those were kind of the first and the last one were kind of key issues with the other one. I'm going to talk about where our industry sits. Food costs, when we were talking about like 4.5% revenue growth and 4.5% labor growth, was before the food costs really kind of hit. Last year, we had 7.6 increase in food costs, which is the highest increase in 23 years.
Wow.
Which I think a lot of people in the local profession expected it to continue, but I don't think they expected it to continue like this. Right now in the first quarter, which is January through March, we had an 8.5% increase in food costs. So the highest one we've had in many years is 7.6, and a quarter we got 8.5%. Now, it looks like this quarter is going to be plus 8% again, so we're going to be talking about potentially a 16% or higher increase in food costs in the first half of the year. That does not count that many of the food suppliers that come to our back door have now added fuel surcharges onto their delivery, which I can't blame them. I mean, fuel costs, but you're looking at, you know, increase in healthcare costs, increase in utility costs, increase in fuel costs. The amount of costs are far exceeding, obviously, the 4.5% revenue projected growth. So profitability in our industry is not doing well. And so I don't know if that's going to impact those two projections that I talked about earlier. The reason I put information on there, I know, there are many costs that go into the way businesses operate on the national level and the state level. And I know that I've spoken to many of you about minimum wage, so it's one indicator. I'm not sitting there saying it's a full indicator, but I think it will outline kind of a good, at least discussion on how our industry in Oregon is a little bit differently than national. Obviously, we passed minimum wage increase in 2002 that had indexes. And the federal government just passed a fairly large short-term increase in minimum wage. And generally, what we've seen in minimum wage increases of a large short-term kind of impact is that it slows employment growth. And so that's why I think Oregon is probably doing better in employment growth than the rest of the country, because they're in the middle of a three-tier increase, and I've outlined those three-tier increases. One of the things you've seen in Oregon, since we have a higher-than-average employment cost, because we have a high minimum wage tip credit, you see fewer employees per restaurant. There's about 15 employees on average here, where the rest of the country is almost 18. Points. I would say from a consumer standpoint, that has some benefits. And what I mean by that is Oregon, unlike much other industries, like I'd say the grocery industry, the hotel industry, has gone into big chains. They got large operations owned with multi-locations. Oregon has tended, because of the labor costs, to be small independents. And I think there's a lot of consumers that enjoy that. Now, I'm not saying that's good or bad, but when you look at it from a business model, which is if I've got 15 employees and one establishment, these food costs are harder to eat up. And to give kind of an extreme example, when you say I've got 10 employees and I've got these costs, if I get rid of one employee, that's 10% of my labor force. Where if I've got 50 employees in one location and two or three locations, I release one or two employees, you're talking about 2% decrease in your labor force. So, I mean, economies of scale, larger operations have a better ability to compensate for these highs and lows. It does make it more difficult in smaller restaurants, independents, to compensate for those. So that's why I'm a little bit worried about those early projections. Can they hold true? And like any economic engine, as long as people continue to spend money, I think we'll survive it okay. It does make it a little bit more difficult. We used to be able to make, you know, we used to talk about limiting your mistakes. Now it's kind of like control your costs and prevent from making any mistakes. And if that has happened, I think they will weather a lot of these. And the last one I just kind of want to touch on is immigration. I think Oregon has had an ability to attract larger industries because of our enjoyment of living, and it's escaping me, the quality of life that Oregon provides. So some of these policies that we've talked about, you know, have still enabled us to attract businesses. We also have a better than average employment force as far as numbers are concerned. Our unemployment rate is slightly higher than the national average. We have 22% of our labor force is foreign-born. They've moved here for some reason. Okay, about 10%, which is about half of, a little less than half of them, probably, we don't be honest. It's about 175,000 workers in Oregon are probably here illegal. But when companies look at locating, they do see us as somebody that's got a higher than average unemployment rate. They've got a higher than average domestic or foreign-born workforce, so we've got a pretty good labor pool to draw from here. So it is an advantage that we have with our quality of life. Now, we as an industry employ about 110,000 people statewide, and so what we're talking about is there's 175,000 illegal workers in here. I just put that in perspective to say that, you know, you can't just get rid of these people. It is a big concern of all industries involved that if you try to remove these workers under the federal programs we're talking about, I think it just dries up. It freezes the economy, if not, you know, makes it crash. And our economy is only really going to exist if we can continue to grow. That's why we're kind of optimistic in the restaurant industry. At least we are projected for some growth. But if we don't have a foreign-born workforce that we can use to fill the gaps, there's going to be very little growth in our economy. Once again, I don't think anybody supports an illegal workforce, but it's just something that I think we need to get a solution to. And I would say it's probably the biggest fear of all industries as of right now is how that is going to be played out. And they want basically a legal workforce that they can draw from. And so I was trying to condense the four pages with supplemental information, but I thought at least it'd be good enough to give you a picture, and if you'd like some different questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
Yeah, thanks for coming, Bill. I schlepped beers and clean urinals all through college. This is another industry that I wouldn't ever. I'd rather dig dirt on a hot summer day than work in a restaurant, because all you're doing is cleaning and frying, and it's hard work, and your feet kill you when you're done working. I just want to comment on a few things here. The food cost increase, we got a perfect storm going on here. You've got droughts in Australia and other places, and rice shortages, and then our what may turn out to be misguided attempts at shifting our energy requirements, taking food out of the food chain and into our gas tank. I'm not sold on all that yet. There's a lot of things going on. We could grow a lot more food here in Oregon, too, if we started taking advantage of the natural, abundant resources we are blessed with in this state. We're incredibly short-sighted for not taking advantage of them, I might add, and I'm not mad at you about that. So there's just a lot going on there, increased in food prices. And the fuel, well, I could yammer on about that one, too. And the minimum wage, I'm not even going to bring up, because you know where I'm at on that, and I just, it's a moot point at this point in time. Forgive some of those who may not agree with me there, but I do want to talk about the immigration, because I know it's probably going to touch on virtually every single other person we have here. You know, this country has to harden that border and keep it porous for commerce, tourism, education, and people that have legitimate reasons to cross that border and be here legally. We need to continue to provide health care to every human being in this country, regardless of where they're from. We need to provide education opportunities to every single child, including in-state tuition, for every child that graduates from our high schools. In the meantime, I think we are going to have to, in my opinion, I would put forth some kind of employer sanction on those who cannot match up their worker with whatever documentation they have. Because the, and then in the meantime, the 12 to 20 million people here, God bless every single one of them. I'm the great-grandson of an Irish immigrant who came here illegally on a boat when he was 12. So I'm a descendant of an illegal immigrant. We need to find a path of citizenship to all those hard workers. And God bless every single one of them, because they are good, wonderful, hard-working human beings. And I'd be proud to have them as an American neighbor. So that's a lot going on there. I don't really know what we in this state are going to be able to do to address a lot of that, but I'm open to suggestions. And so with that, I'm going to get off my stump and open up. Any questions for Mr. Perry here?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
How many panels do we have coming up?
We have one, two, three, four more. Excuse me, three more people.
Okay, then I will limit my questions.
Okay.
You were talking about the growth in the restaurant industry, or your projected growth. Is that, I mean, with all the doomsday that's out there, some of the information that you presented, economic projections and whatnot, is this growth coming from lifestyle changes, people eating, just, you know, people going to their local neighborhood restaurant and eating out more often, or is it from tourism, or just the state's population growth? I mean, where's that coming from?
Chair Schopler, Representative Edwards, I would say kind of all of the above. I do think the tourism, with the 1%, if you guys remember that, statewide lodging tax, add a lot to it. We're probably one of the things benefactors of culinary tourism. The thing that I talked about, and like I said, I wasn't asking necessarily for a change in minimum wage when I was outlining that, but I do think that there are some pluses and minuses for the way it's worked out. And I would say that when you look at the restaurant styles that we have, which are the smaller independents and everything else, it's been an attractive thing to where the people that come to Portland for culinary tourism spend more money than any other tourists we've got. So I think that is a factor. You've got a natural population growth that is always going to kind of add on to it. Usually when you look at factors of employment growth, you base it strictly on really where population growth is. And the average employment growth from all industries is about 1.2%. You know, we're going to be closer to 4.5%. So you usually base it on, you know, how you look compared to other industries, because people say industries are still growing. But if you're below that curve, you know, to be a strong economy, you have to grow. I truly believe that that's the way ours work. And so we are benefiting probably more than other industries. But it's population growth, it's tourism, and it is, you know, some of that is just going to be dollars spent because costs have gone up. So some of that revenue is just inflationary, for lack of a better term. It's not more meal, it's just a little bit. So there's a bunch of factors that play into it. Like I said, my comments really were kind of skeptical, because I don't think people were predicting the amount of food cost growth. And so as that happens, it happens at the grocery stores too. Consumers are going to start making different choices. How are those food costs going to affect those choices and the final outcome? I don't know. I'm just telling you that's what it was. I do think that there is a possibility that number could come down a bit, just because sure food costs are increasing at such a great level. Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, if I could add kind of to your immigration, I don't think any employer group has said that employer sanctions should not be part of the package. It's just one of the frustrating parts with this immigration issue is either states or Congress are trying to address it on an individual issue type basis. And when you look at what passed the House and Congress last year and what got 56 votes, I think, in the Senate but didn't get cloture, it had employer sanctions, it had border security, and it had some sort of a program on how we deal with the current workers that are here. You know, we were fine with that. It is a problem. It's just these statewide solutions that have happened in Arizona and Oklahoma and the individual bills. This problem has gotten so far out of control, you can't address it in any locality or individual issue basis. It's got to be handled completely. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that we'd be against employer sanctions. We would be against them as a standalone issue, because
we all need the workforce. As a consumer, we all need the workforce. So,
Bill, on the minimum wage, I don't want to minimize that either. Yeah. I know it's an extra cost. I mean, I can do the math. So I don't want to minimize that. I want to recognize that. So even though I think statutorily it's a moot point, legislatively a moot point, I don't want to minimize. I did not want you to think I minimized that extra cost. On the immigration, I'm willing to be patient. I don't need to run in here and on January 15th pass some immigration bill next year, assuming that I'm here. I'm more than willing to be patient. If we see some movement on the federal government, I think we're going to have a new president. I know we're going to have a new president. I think it's going to be the right president, and I think we're going to move forward in a very productive way. But I have shown in the past that I'm willing to be patient and wait to see what the federal government does. I know my good friend to the right here from Eugene has been rather vexed at my times at my willingness to wait to see what the federal government does in other areas of industry, but I hope you're right. Once again, we have to find a path to citizenship to the people that are here. We're not going to round up a bunch of people and cart them out of this country. It's just simply not going to happen. Now, we need these workers, and you've made that abundantly clear. So, but I appreciate you commenting on that. I know there's a large coalition out there working on this, and they surveyed me on the phone. I made it very clear. I thought some of the questions were leading. I didn't agree with some of the premises of the questions, and I had some other fine words thrown in there for some of our good friends. Any questions of Mr. Perry here? Representative Cameron.
Mr. Perry,
do you let me know whether or not you like my testimony?
If you're recommending to one of your members how high they should raise their prices based on this, what would you tell them? Especially if there was a restaurant in the capital.
That's an interesting question.
Are you seeing prices go up?
Yes.
At the restaurants, and to what degree?
Yes, the interesting thing about our industry is obviously it's very diverse, and one of the things that that tends to happen in hard times is when I was talking about the independent operator, the family casual, people that are not high end but serve families, try to get price points, are the ones that are really in trouble, because people want to go out as families and go out to eat, so they're willing to spend $50 for a family of four. If they raise their prices too much, I think they're in trouble. Your high-end restaurants, if you think of the most expensive place you go, they generally don't tend to be in as much trouble, because during the week they're 80%, this is a guess number, but just to put it in perspective, 80% of it is expense business, where they're trying to entertain customers, and on the weekends it's all, anniversaries, it's special occasions, and somebody isn't going to move down the chain to satisfy you at the school. So I think the high-end guys can generally raise their prices and probably still be okay, and those people that move from the family casual places maybe go down to a quick service. And so you see that part of the industry can benefit. Not saying they all do, but they can benefit. And so those two have more flexibility than those middle people. But I think those middle people are the ones that, in my opinion, make Oregon restaurants what they are. So they're going to have the difficult time. They're going to try to have to prevent from raising prices. But as you can see with those numbers, not raising prices at that level is very difficult, and profitability is going to be really, really hard for them. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Any further questions of Mr. Perry today? All right.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. Bob Shiprack, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I'm here today to briefly respond to the question from the committee about the state of the construction industry, specifically related to workforce issues, is what I
going to tend to concentrate my comments on today. I want to thank you for this opportunity because it's interesting, it's a coincidence perhaps, that in the last 6 months I've been spending a lot of personal time on this very issue of construction workforce issues. I recently had a meeting called by the State of Oregon, various construction arms of the State of Oregon, ODOT, DAS, etc., and they had some of my contractors there, big contractors that I think everybody in the committee would recognize, who restated what I call some of the myths about the workforce in construction, that we're all too old and there's nobody out there and what's going to happen in the future, woe is me. And it's been my experience just going out on job sites that I don't see this stuff. So I got a hold of an old friend of mine who works down the mall here. It's Art Ear. He's the state labor economist. I've known Art for many years. And interestingly enough, they had just completed a report that I wanted to get new copies. This is just out. And for your committee that wants to look at workforce issues for the entire Oregon workforce, I can't recommend a better pamphlet. It's brand new. And it hits on some of the issues that have concerned me and you hear about in the media. I developed this little op-ed that I emailed to all the legislature. I'm trying to get it in various newspapers and construction magazines, but with some success. But I'm trying to address some of the myths that we keep hearing about and hopefully understand better what's really going on, at least in my industry. First of all, I mean, you can read it. Myth one, our workforce is too old. Actually, the state has discovered that construction workers are the third youngest group of workers in the whole state. And you can see that there's actually relatively few over 55. In the vast bulk of the workforce is between 25 and 44, which I spotted that by any visit to a construction site. You got a bunch of just old people there. Yes, too. There are not enough young people to take their place. You hear this all the time. And so I started at the state Department of Education looking at graduating seniors. Well, they don't really count that way. So they got me to I didn't know we had a state demographer. They got back to me. And a very interesting statistics. Actual decline in 18-year-olds ended in 1986. And it's been an increasing number all along. And in fact, nationally, we've never had so many graduating seniors nationally as we did this year. In Oregon, we set a new record of hitting about 54,000 18-year-olds this year, perhaps leveling off or slight decline. So there's more people coming into the workforce than we've had in a long, long time. The other interesting fact that Art found that I see, but I never had it quantified, was the vast amount of in-migration we have into this state is a significant number. A lot of people are moving here to work. And clearly in construction, we call them travelers, but when there is a lot of construction work, people from all over the United States come into Oregon, fill a void if there is one. Usually there isn't that big of a void. And then they go back or to another state to work. Finally, myth number three is I can't get any workers. How many times have we heard that? Art goes and analyzes that. And it's very interesting what his, and I'll just encapsulate his final comments about that statement. And it's quoted in the handout that you're given. Employers unable to provide competitive employee compensation may face a serious shortage of workers. However, those employers who provide good wages, benefits, training, which I found interesting, training and treat their employees good, have no problem getting employees and keeping them. So I look at that, and then I look at my industry,
We spend a lot on training. The union apprenticeship programs spend conservatively $30 million a year in Oregon for apprenticeship and training. We have over 3,000, and I think it's probably closer, I need to check, probably closer to about 4,000 registered apprentices in Oregon. I surveyed my own people about this. I said, are you having any problem getting people? I go, no, we're not having any problem getting people at all. So I checked even with some of my small unions, and one the chair would appreciate. My family was all Samantha's, and so I checked with my Samantha's. It's a very small union. And I said, are you having trouble getting people? And they go, we just took 42 in last week. Not a problem. And the reason is, where else, and think about, where else can a kid that never is going to go to college go out, get some good training, and make $40,000 minimum in about 3 years? Nowhere. Nowhere. They're not going to find that anywhere else. And so you have a large pool of young people, women, minorities, who are attracted to construction because of the natural advantages that we have. One of the things I also surveyed, because the legislature 2 sessions ago put a note, a budget note on ODOT's budget that they were going to have a certain level of apprenticeship hours. It's fairly modest. I would encourage you to take a look at it. I'm gonna meet with Representative Holby and go over it if he hasn't seen it, because it's right up his line of what he's been looking at. I wasn't happy with the numbers, however. So I pulled, and then there was allegations that we don't have any people out of work. We don't have any apprentices. ODOT themselves pulled the 5 rising crops that are employed on bridge construction because of the OTA bridge program. Carpenters, laborers, cement masons, iron workers, and operating engineers. Out of that total, as of about 3 weeks ago, we had 500 people available for work, apprentices, or on the list of availables. Those have already been accepted in the apprenticeship program, but simply need a chance to go to work. So I want to dispel that myth that we don't have people available. In my area of the industry, if we don't have unemployment, we create in order to maintain a list of available workers. The last thing that kind of leads into this, and then I'm going to be quiet, the chair asked for this, and actually it flows right in with what I'm talking about. The only study I've ever seen, and some of you that have been on this committee before have seen this or heard about it, it equates wages and productivity with actual production. And what the federal, this is Federal Highway Administration data. They want to know what their costs are around the country, who they relate to, because they spend billions of dollars. And so it's totally unbiased. They just want to know what the numbers are, and they take wages, and then what is the actual cost to build a bridge or a mile of asphalt? And you look at this, you can take a look at the conclusions and everything else, and that Oregon is a relatively high-wage state, which we are in construction, yet we're among the bottom 6 in the cost to the taxpayers of the road work that we do. And it's all based on the good training and productivity of the workforce. You take a look at Texas, they got a whopping average wage of $11 an hour, yet their costs are 3 times what it costs in Oregon. So it's just a good study that it's the only one I found that I think is irrefutable. It's by an unbiased group. It's data that the federal government wanted to collect it, and it just shows the relationship between good training, good wages, and actual savings to the taxpayer. And I would, it doesn't measure quality, but I got to tell you, traveling around the country, I would put the quality of our projects against any place in the United States as well. So with that, I'll be quiet and ask any questions that you may have.
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for coming in. As you know, I'm pretty biased on these issues. And
really?
I don't think there's any. Yes, I am. And for damn good reason, Representative. I will benefit from my time in the union for the rest of my life in many, many ways. But, you know, as I said earlier, when the nurses issue is in here, happy workers make for happy products. And not only that, a well-trained, well-compensated workforce is more efficient. It's safer. And your turnover rate's a lot less, saving everybody time and money. And these folks don't sit there and bury their money in a mason jar in the backyard. They go out and buy houses and trucks and washing machines and eat at restaurants and take their kids to the dentist and provide education and health care opportunities for their whole family. It's no revelation to me that people that are willing, employers, responsible employers who are willing to pay good workers a good day's wage with benefits are having no problem finding work. I moved to this state in 1988 with my college degree, and the best job I could get was working in the labor's union. And oftentimes I regret leaving the labor's union. Now, also it'll be no revelation that, and it comes no surprise to me, that you aren't going to see a lot of guys or gals over 55 out of these job sites because it's hard work. So I'm going to shut up, too. I do appreciate you bringing me all this stuff. And, you know, there was recently in a trade magazine a call to repeal the Davis-Bacon Act and all its state equivalents. You know what? When we talk about the economy here and where it's going or may go, I cannot think of a more irresponsible idea than repealing the Davis-Bacon Act and all its state's equivalents. On the contrary, we need to strengthen the Davis-Bacon Act and all of its state's equivalent, and that is going to be my intention next session. I'm just going to say it right now. So with that, I'm going to shut up and open it to Representative Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, we have had discussions in the past, you and I, about, you know, K-12 system and how it can complement our blue-collar labor force in the state of Oregon, skilled labor. You know, less than 18% of all high school students graduate out of college. Fact. Mm-hmm. Yet, everything in school in K-12, especially high school, is geared toward college, which is very interesting. Have we made any headway to get the education system itself, the K-12 system, to have a transitional workforce that can work into an apprenticeship program eventually and go through a transition between the high schools, the community colleges, and then into the apprenticeship programs and the workforce itself, the skilled laborers? We still have the joke in Southern Oregon that would you rather hire a neurosurgeon or a plumber? And the answer is the neurosurgeon because it costs less and the availability is better. Plumbers, they make great money. Electricians make great money. Framers make great money. Drywall, you know, I mean, the industry goes on and on and on. And yet we don't seem to gear our education system towards people that we know won't go to college. And that, to me, is 82% of the population of the school kids today will not go to college or complete college. And yet everything's geared toward that. And are you seeing any change in that, Bob? Because you and I have discussed this pretty, you know, great length.
I'm Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, I'm seeing glacial change in that. Senator Schrader passed a very minor appropriation last session. I helped him with the North Platinum School District was involved in it because they have a vocational school, maybe the best in the state. They're looking at what it would take to better serve the vocational needs of students. The Department of Education is looking at other states now. There'll be a report back. But I must tell you, it is a very sad state of affairs. I know my own son went to Colton High School. I said, why aren't you taking shop class? And he says, I am, except all the tools are all broken and none of the motors work. They don't repair them. There's no money for these programs. And I blame that on the school boards. I don't know where else to put the blame. I mean, they're the ones who appropriate this money. We know from a fact that we spend a lot of time in the high schools. unfortunately, the guidance counselors are still college orientated. That's why we really have more success after they're out of high school. They're looking around for employment and hear about getting in the trades. It's word of mouth, I got to tell you. And I to be so bold, I appreciate so much you asked this question. I really think it's the responsibility of the legislature. When you're appropriating $70 billion worth of education money, you ought to hopefully take a look at diverting some of that into vocational programs. I mean, that's my own personal opinion.
The other thing that I would just like to share with everyone is that I went to a workforce seminar in Southern Oregon, geared for Southern Oregon, and it's very hard to believe, but we have over 1,000, I repeat, over 1,000 family wage jobs that we can't fill. It's not because we don't have the people available, yeah, which we just stated, but the unfortunate thing is lack of mathematics, lack of ability to read, but the big one is they can't pass a drug test. That's the big one. And that's most unfortunate.
That is the first test we give aspiring apprentices, and most oftentimes when they learn about that, they don't show up for it. We don't see them anymore. And it is a big problem, bigger than I thought.
Yeah, you know, Representative, I have to comment on what you're talking about. Well, I grew up in Iowa, and Iowa is known for having an excellent school system, and I'm a product of it. Maybe not the best example of their products, but that being said, I graduated from high school, and we had every shop class you can imagine available to us. Wood shop, electricity, plastics, metals, welding, auto. And since then, my brother still lives in that town, that community has cut back on that. And I don't know where, if it's due to lack of resources. I mean, we could always spend more money on education, and I support that concept. I don't know. I think it is the direction. And I want, you know, you have to know math if you're going to be a carpenter or an electrician or a laborer. You have to know how to read your tape measure, period. That's all there is to it. And there's some real complex math goes into rigging something if you're the bellman. All kinds of stuff out there. But I couldn't agree more. We have to concentrate on it. Not everyone is cut out to or has the aptitude or the inclination to go to college. And God bless those that do. But I couldn't agree more. We need to direct our resources at this very clear need. On the drug testing, this committee, if I am so blessed as being the chair, and I am going to chief sponsor a bill that will not neither mandate the employer will be not mandated to either accommodate or not accommodate a medical marijuana card holder. We just cannot say it's okay to have marijuana in your system if you are the bellman or the carpenter or the iron worker or the electrician or the crane operator or the truck driver. We can't do it. Now, if an employer has a relationship with a valued employee and they want to manage that risk with in full knowledge of what's going on, God bless them. I'm not opposed to that idea. But for the idea that this state is going to mandate in any way, shape, or form an employer to keep an employee on the job site in full knowledge that they have a medical marijuana card and full knowledge that they have marijuana in their system is just flat out wrong and dangerous. This is not a health care committee. I think the health care committee should actually take a good hard look at the benefits of providing medical marijuana cards to people for chronic pain. I'm not a doctor, but anyone who claims to have pain can say they have chronic pain. And there's no way in God's green earth to measure. I believe some people do need a medical marijuana for pain, glaucoma, terminal illnesses of various kinds. There's a need for medical marijuana. I support the medical marijuana card concept completely, but certainly not on the job site. Representative Escobar.
Yeah, just to thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to enlighten that, I just did a panel discussion with Representative Buckley and Senator Bates on that very issue. It came out.
They didn't invite me, Representative.
Well, it's okay. There was two of us on one side. So, and it came out that less than 1,000 people in the state of Oregon, if we would have adhered to the law on medical marijuana criteria, would actually need it. Do you realize there's over 17,000 cardholders in the state of Oregon today? One doctor, before they got rid of him and put him out of practice, allocated over 8,000 people with that card. The other thing that we didn't think of as voters, which never, I mean, how would we know? A marijuana plant, you're allowed 5 of those to grow, I believe, the way the law is. They grow 8 to 10 to 12 feet tall. Do you realize how much that is?
It's a lot of reefer.
So, I think that the conclusion of the panel was this. And first of all, I don't think that will ever happen, that we allow that in the workforce. I mean, they had these certain jobs. They said, well, we can't allow it on this job and this job. But they didn't talk about your doctor. They didn't talk about your stockbroker. And your stockbroker is the one that's going to have your future in their hands. A lot of things they didn't discuss. But anyway, to make a long story short, I don't think it'll happen,
Representative.
But more importantly, I think the crux of that meeting came out. Everyone agrees we should modify the law, even though we all agree it should never be done away with. But there needs to be some kind of a modification in that law when you have 17,000 people that are under card-carrying ability to have that privilege.
I agree, Representative, and we may have gone a little astray here, but I once again will not. We're going to. I look forward to having legislation that will neither mandate nor prohibit an employer from accommodating medical marijuana cardholder. Are there any other questions from the good Mr. Shipback? Representative Holby.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted an opportunity to say kumbaya to most everything that's been said. You know, even the medical marijuana issue, I think the AGC and Representative Buckley finally came to an agreement in February about proposing a modification to that, which I would support. And, you know, I really appreciate, Bob, your comments about the trades, and as always, and comments about prevailing wage. You know, I am total agreement with most everything, and just wanted to let you know that. I look forward to talking to you about some of these new data that has come out.
I have some interesting stuff to show you.
Yeah, but you know, we've gotten a lot of stuff from the employment department, and you know, I serve on the Workforce and Economic Development Committee, which has also spent a great deal of time on the specific issues, and actually had a meeting in February where they had the Education Committee and the Workforce Development Committee talking together about vocational education and what we need to do about getting kids skilled up, at least exposed to it at the high school level. And so I'm hoping that we do have some great movement in 09 on that subject.
Any further questions or comments? All right, thanks, Bob. Steve Carlson. Come on up, Steve. And as you've just heard, the carpenters and the laborers and the electricians are all in agreement.
Chairman Shopworth, members of the committee, appreciate you having me here this morning. My name is Steve Carlson, business representative of the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. I currently chair the Marion Polk 1057 JETC, which many know as the Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee. I also sit on the State Carpenter Apprenticeship Committee. And appreciate Bob Shipwreck's comments. I'm going to kind of expand a little more on the apprenticeship end of that. I could mention that, you know, Bob said, you know, the workforce, we have the youngest workforce in the state of Oregon. Our current average age of apprenticeship in the carpenters is still 27, which I think a lot of times we find these young folks get into the trades, they have to fall on their face a few times, get some of life's knocks before they actually, some of them are returns that come back later and continue on. But I think the carpenter's end of it, you're going to see a little more mass exodus. Just kind of a trickle right now, but we do have a lot of members that will be retiring in the next, within the next 10 years. You know, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about the workforce needs of the construction industry. As you know, the construction industry requires skilled workers in various trades, and you need training to obtain those skills. Apprenticeship programs are the most successful path to producing workers with those necessary skills, journeymen, for the construction industry. Much of the construction industry today, they operate through a CMGC, which is a construction management general contractor scenario, where they actually employ subcontractors to do a lot of the individual tasks on the job, a little different than, say, 20 years ago when a general contractor would perform those from ground up. I know part of the concept this morning was specialty trades, and I just want to touch briefly on some of the specialty trades that umbrella under the carpenters. The carpenters currently, we do concrete formwork, wood framing, finished carpentry, mill cabinet work, wood flooring, doors and hardware installation. We have exterior interior specialists. We do metal stud drywall framing, acoustical ceilings. Carpenters also represent pile drivers, bridge builders, wharf and dock builders, and divers, and millwrights who perform turbine, machinery, equipment, conveyor installation, and also scaffold erectors. The carpenters provide apprenticeship and training for all these various trades, and most of these individual trades are subcontractors that do that work currently. It has changed dramatically probably since Chairman Schaffer yourself started in the trades, where you had a general contractor that did it from ground up, from start to finish. The carpenters currently have the largest apprenticeship committee in the state, with over 1,000 active apprentices, which represent over 10% total for the state currently. Those programs are mostly four-year programs with 4 weeks of in-class training per year and the balance in on-the-job training. Apprenticeship training takes great commitment from employers and employees. Our union programs are funded by participating employers through hourly contributions per worker. We currently, through the carpenters, each working member pays 60 cents per hour that goes into training. It's not specific, split out for as far as apprenticeship and journeyman advancement, but it goes into one pool that covers both of those aspects of it. However, the majority of construction contractors in Oregon do not participate in or contribute to apprenticeship programs. It's important to stress the commitment and effort needed by the apprentice to successfully complete an apprenticeship program with the standards required to be successful. We strive to attract quality applicants into our program. There are a few areas I feel that would greatly help with recruitment in the construction trades industry. The first is more focus on vocational training and shop classes in our high schools, which a couple representatives talked about here earlier. I know at Washington State, they have a running start to the trades. They've been partnering with the high schools. We've been trying to work harder here in the state of Oregon, and just like Mr. Shiprock stated earlier, it's pretty tough when you have all these young kids coming out of school and they don't have that avenue. You know, most of our workforce development dollars are spent pointing young people to college, and there are very few, I believe the number is about 18%, that actually graduate. So there is a big void there that could be filled through our apprenticeship and training programs. Our schools are more and more focused on preparing students for college. We actively recruit young people through partnerships with, these are just a few of them, Terrell Tribal Employment Rights Organization, ETAP, Evening Trades Apprenticeship Program, Job Corps, Youth Build, Helmets to Hard Hats, the Unemployment Department, Women in the Trades, Summer Construction Camp, which is another one that the carpenters started a couple of years ago in Portland. They take, I think this year we've got a little over 20 students or juniors in high school that actually work on the job site 3 months of summer. They're paid a wage, and part of that they attended our training center. So it's kind of giving them a taste of what the construction world is. A lot of these young kids step into the trades. I know myself personally, 30 years ago, first job, put a safety belt, hung me 60 feet in the air, it scared the hell out of me. So just walking on a large construction site can be pretty intimidating for a lot of these young folks. And I think
some of these programs, and hopefully they'll get more of these things started, even, you know, through workforce development, and allow these kids to get a taste of that early on, so at least they have some career options when they come out of high school. Another area of great importance is keeping apprentices in the program through completion. Our current overall completion ratio for carpenter apprentices statewide is 35%, and that's a four-year average. Our goal is to recruit the best of the best. Applicants that are not serious about apprenticeship and don't fulfill their obligations are terminated to allow another more committed applicant from the rank list to fill that slot. We currently have quite a rank pool of members, you know, waiting to go to work here through our different JTC committees in the state of Oregon. When the economy gets slower, specific contractors' work slows. Apprentices often are laid off to have to find work with another contractor who does not provide apprenticeship opportunities. With the demographics of retiring workforce and the additional workforce needed in the construction industry, we need to be proactive and train more people to meet our future needs. The industry will need at least 22,000 additional tradespeople by the year 2016, according to the Employment Department. And those people need to have the skill and training as necessary in an increasingly more technical and demanding construction industry. We need to do a better job of encouraging contractors to provide job opportunities for apprentices. We need commitment from contractors, project developers, and owners, and government contracting agencies to provide more job opportunities for apprentices. Public projects in Oregon should require apprenticeship utilization. What better way to utilize tax dollars than training the future tax-paying citizens of Oregon on prevailing wage projects? This would also create job opportunities for them to complete their training. Area standard wage jobs with benefits, in turn, reduce the impact on public service assistance. Another one I'll touch on, and Bob shed a little light on and go a little more in-depth into it, is agency oversight and accountability. I feel that plays a key role in this process. The training programs need to not only meet but maintain the established state standards. The ODOT Workforce Development Program on state bridge projects provide an example. The apprenticeship goals established per bridge project and the workers generated from the alliance pool have gone backwards because of their failure to produce. I don't feel that ODOT has upheld its legislative mandate to ensure by craft that apprenticeship levels have been met. Currently, ODOT is implementing a program that will pay apprentices $20 per hour to work on highway projects. There is, however, no oversight to ensure the apprenticeship hours per project obligation is met. And I heard here last week, I think the first project that's been let that will start this process is one on I-5 yourself in Corvallis. There are programs that don't meet the standards and contractors that are not fulfilling their obligation with no consequences. We currently meet or exceed the requirements of the industry while other programs can't generate a pool of qualified applicants. Again, there needs to be accountability and oversight included in the process. The carpenters have an individual who oversees ODOT projects both on misclassification and apprenticeship issues. The current tracking data on apprentices does not match certified payroll in many cases. Again, oversight and accountability. To give an example, I didn't include it. I was kind of rushed getting my information put together, but the MLP project up in Portland, by ODOT Civil Rights, numbers that they're tracking as far as apprentices, they show zero on their project, and actually there's 12. So the statistics just aren't clear. So if they don't have the numbers on them, we'll probably only see how many apprentices are working on each project. My understanding, I heard this just in this past week, that currently ODOT is the site to monitor apprenticeship by a total of all apprentice job hours worked, not by specific craft. This only ensures the least qualified and trained workforce is produced. The quality of training should not be jeopardized by programs that don't fulfill the requirements established through bullying or contracts that contractors that abuse the system. And again, I appreciate you having me here this morning. I was kind of rushed putting things together, but if you need any further information, I'd be happy to provide that for you.
Thanks, Steve. I joined the union when I was 28. I was wandering aimlessly in and out of college, eventually graduated, but you know, I'm not surprised at that age. I think, you know, young people don't know what they want to do a lot of times. And when I talk to the young guys or gals about the trades, I say go to the labor's union and work there for a while and take a look at the trades and see what interests you. You know, rather than just diving into one apprenticeship program, get a good look at what's going on out there. But once again, I'm all for math. You got to know math. I'm all for training people and educating people to be successful. But I think we have neglected this, and I'm just grateful for all the work you're doing out there, training good, hardworking young Americans. Representative Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you think, in your opinion, or maybe give me a best guess, you stated that the actual hours of apprenticeship was different than the certified hours.
Correct.
Is that just due to poor accounting, or are we just gun decking it?
Well, and questions have been, we've asked questions directly to ODOT of where those numbers are being generated, and we haven't gotten an answer back on that yet. But you would think that, you know, if the workforce development, if they're trying to generate apprentices and show hours, and the tracking shows zero, and there's 12 on the job, there's something amiss in that.
How long ago did you request the numbers, and if they give you a reason why they haven't gotten it to you yet?
These requests were a few weeks ago.
Oh, okay. No. Representative, you want to follow up?
Oh, no, thank you.
Any Representative Holdy.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, thanks for coming down and providing your testimony. Appreciate it. And the panel knows I work with Steve. We both have the same employer. So one of the things that I suppose that has come out in that we have a lot of programs out there, and you know, it seems like some programs are doing well and some aren't, and there's a lot of standards that they have to meet. And one of the problems is you mentioned a completion ratio that the carpenters have, but I know that some programs don't do very well with completion ratios and some do very well. And I'm wondering, does Boldy have any requirements or enforcement of what those standards should be and what happens when they're not met?
Well, I know that Boldy does have standards, but whether it's enforced or not is another question. I know that currently, well, there's three different apprenticeship committees representing carpenters here in the state of Oregon. It's 1057, which is the union carpenter end of it, 1074, which is Oregon Columbia chapter, Northwest College of Construction, and then 3038, which is Lane and Douglas County. And their actual completion ratios, Columbia was 8% for your average, Lane and Lynn County was 7% for your average. So I think the standards are there. I don't think a lot of times they're followed through. One question I've always had is with the way our system is based, it's a dispatch type system, where on the open shop side, if a young person is laid off, I don't know how they cycle those people back into the system because they don't have a dispatch type scenario. So
we're going to hear from that in a minute. But it's a good question. I look forward to hearing the answer. I want to go. Are you finished, Representative?
Yeah, I am to a certain degree. I just have a comment, is that in the Workforce and Economic Committee, Boley had stated that statewide we're graduating less than 900 apprentices a year, and with the Employment Department saying that, you know, we're going to need 22,000 more tradespeople by the year 2016, you know, it just, the numbers don't add up. Either we're not going to have qualified, skilled people in these projects, or we're going to have a big immigration of people coming in, as been suggested as too. But it does look like we have challenges to me, and that's something that you know, we have talked about in the Workforce and Economic Development Committee and this committee as well, and hopefully we can work towards a solution to that, and maybe part of it's
through the high schools, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
I hope we have way more than enough projects, and we need more workers. That's what I want to see. Building America here in Oregon. Representative Edwards.
A really quick clarifying question. You said there's, you went through the completion rates. Could you define, you said 7 to 8%. Is that 7 to 8% of folks who enter the apprenticeship program?
Yeah.
Is that what that means?
Chairman Schaffer, Representative Edwards, the formula you use, and I couldn't lay that out for you. I could get that information to you through the training center, but it's an average over, this is a 4-year average. They break it down year by year also. But the actual formula, how they surmise, because you got apprentices coming and dropping out the first year, I think they just take total from end to end, but okay. there is an actual formula that they go through. I couldn't tell you exactly.
So for every 100 that enter the program, somewhere in the range of 7 to 8 graduate from the program. Is that
representative?
Maybe I can help clarify. I'm sure Bob can help clarify that 7 to 8% were for two specific programs that he was speaking of, where. The union program that he was speaking of graduated 35%, and some programs like electricians, I think, are up above 50%, 80%, you know, and so there's a wide range of programs out there, I think was the point he was trying to make. So, you know, that's one of the issues he was speaking to is the standards that these programs should live up to. Isn't always met, and so it kind of skews the numbers a little bit when you go looking at these things.
Okay, thanks for that clarification.
So I'm sure ODOT, the good people are at ODOT right now are very diligently looking for those numbers for you right now as we speak. But if you feel they need some encouragement from this committee, please feel free to ask us and give me the contact information, and we'll give them a call and see how we can be of help.
Chairman Schaffer, I appreciate that. I know that you know, we all put a lot of time and effort in that. And we all played a part. I think all the trades participated region by region when they went through that original process. And, you know, I had called the gentleman for civil rights a couple weeks ago to participate in another one. But we have a ranked list, a huge ranked list of young folks willing and ready to go to work. So, appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right. Mr. Killen. Mr. Miller, you want to come up today? Okay. John, you want to come on up here?
Good morning, Chair Schaffer, committee members. John Killen speaking on behalf of the Independent Electrical Contractors and the Associate Builders and Contractors. Instead of reading my lengthy testimony, I'll keep it brief. We're getting close to lunch, and I never like to be in the way of food. I want to speak for a moment on where the industry is. In July of 2000, the construction industry started shrinking. And that's, we hit a recession, we hit the bubble, and things started shrinking, including the construction industry. That kept up until about October or November of 2003. Then it picked up really fast. And so when we came to you in 2005 and started talking about ratios and we need more people, we were in the midst of a massive movement. We were seeing 10% gains month over month over month. And so here we are. The residential market has slowed down considerably, as you all know. But many of those residential contractors, and particularly the subs, the electricians, the plugs, the plumbers, excuse me, etc., have moved into small commercial. And so we've seen this. We actually can demonstrate it using apprenticeship work hours. We saw it early this year, February in particular, we saw this massive shift from residential into commercial. And so the commercial is booming right now. It's huge. It's going really well. But we're not seeing the workforce scare that we saw 2 years ago because the residential did slow down. In talking with our general contractors and people around the country, really, what we see is about 12 to 18 months worth of backlog. And that's general contractors looking out saying, we know we're going to be working and we have projects that have already been started or are going to definitely be started for another good solid year. In about that same year, the residential guys are saying, we're going to start building houses again. And so we think there's going to be a little shift in pretty much 12 months from now, a shift from commercial back to residential. But this, it's going to be many of the same people doing the work. It's the same electricians, they're licensed for both, same plumbers, etc. The generals, though, the residential generals, you know, particularly the big guys, we've seen them go from 200 employees down to 5. The commercial generals will probably be the same in 12 to 24 months is kind of the expectation right now. That's what I'm being told by a lot of my folks. So with that said, the construction industry employs around 100,000 people out of the 1.7 million working organizations. So about 6% of the whole group. Of that group, a pretty large percentage works in the residential sector or service sector. A lot of our limited energy technicians that we consider contractors are really coming in, and they're not in new construction. They are putting in wires and cables and fire systems and retrofitting, remodeling, and all of those sorts of things. Of that 100,000 folks, it's estimated it's been which employment figure and which month you get it, but it's about 15% are affiliated with a union. The rest are working non-union, and some are you know, they frankly are unskilled. That's not true. They are untrained and uneducated. A landscape person who's doing nothing but running a wheelbarrow, for instance, is still in that number. With that said, we're very much pro education, pro apprenticeship. The as Mr. Shipwreck pointed out, about 4,000 apprentices are being run through union halls or union trade centers. There are about now, depending on the day, 8,000 to 9,000 total apprentices in the state. And so the rest are being run through non-union shops. And so my group represents a good portion of those, not all or even a majority, but a major portion of those. And so we have a big vested interest in making sure apprenticeship's running well. And we have those good completion rates, and we are getting those trained employees. And our contractors know that a trained employee is much more valuable than an untrained employee. One statistic I heard recently was that for every year of apprenticeship, the individual became 8 to 10% more productive. And so after a four-year apprenticeship, they're, in theory, 30 to 40% more productive than the untrained person. Some of the things I want to hit on as well, some of the barriers that we're seeing about getting people into the trades, and keep everybody else's remarks in mind. It's, we're not seeing the big scare today, but there are barriers to getting people into the trades. One we've already talked about is it's getting into the high schools and the young people, getting them interested. One of the things we're doing is working on what we refer to as youth apprenticeship, and that is setting up centers where they can come in, learn some of the basic skills, take some classes in safety and basic electrical work or basic plumbing work, and start getting out on the job, getting familiar with the worksite. They get paid, they get an education, and when they decide to enter the full adult apprenticeship, they have a leg up. They get get credit for their first term of apprenticeship. So we're working on that with Boley right now. We're actually working with Salem area. We think Chemeketa might be a great partner to be kind of a regional center. We found high school by high school, you just can't financially do it. You're talking such a small percentage of kids to start with that the high schools aren't willing to change their curriculums and start over. Where somebody like Chemeketa is much more willing to do something because they see a larger route coming through. This is something that Labor Commissioner Bakken is very interested in as well. We spoke with him this morning. he noted that this is his number one thing, is to get CHOP and get trades back into high schools and start producing some young people that can come into the trades a little more quickly and easily. Then, as you pointed out and has been stated, we're seeing a lot of 27, 28-year-olds coming into apprenticeship. If we can get them a little sooner, maybe we can get a few more productive years out of them. May sound very much like products there, but you get the idea. As well, one of the things that is a barrier, we talked about 2 years ago, is apprenticeship ratios. It's our folks would probably hire and train more apprentices if the ratios were a little different. We recognize that there are some concerns over safety. We haven't seen any demonstration of actual safety problems with changing ratios, but this is one of those barriers that over time could be adjusted. We want to encourage Boley to continue an effort they're working on right now. They are working on the standards and rules of how who qualifies and how a person gets into apprenticeship. It's a very complicated system where you apply through a lengthy application, you get ranked, and you get pulled into a group and then get pulled in and then indentured in. The problem is that we have criteria that are important. They're things like math ability. The problem is right now we define math ability as, did you ever take algebra? That might have been 20 years ago. Might have been 30 years ago. Doesn't mean you remember it today. I know I took a couple more. I can't do anything today. I really do algebra at this point. They are working on some of those standards and changing. The point to a lot of the rules were, frankly, affirmative action. Get more minorities and women. And frankly, over the years that we've had these rules in place, not much has changed. It wouldn't have changed anyway. And so I think they are taking a real solid look right now, and they have a multi-committee group working on this, to take a real serious view on what can be done better. How can we have better entrance in, more easy entrance in, and base it on competency to learn the math, not on how to get it. And we think that could change quite a bit. Finally, we encourage a lot more apprenticeship and training programs to get started. There's a lot of areas that aren't serviced fully by an apprenticeship and training program. We think there should be more. There should be more opportunity and more competition to allow for the improvement of the whole training scenario. So we think competition is a good thing to drive people. So with that, if I may go back to a couple of the comments. I think there were a couple questions on how OpenShop does if a carpenter or an electrical apprentice is out of work. The system is pretty similar to the trade call situation. It's the apprentice calls in, says I'm out of work, or the contractor says we laid so and so off. We put them onto an out of work list, and anytime a contractor calls up, they say, well, I want another apprentice, I need somebody new. We say, well, here are three. You can choose the top three. Here's the whole out-of-work list. And it's different from committee to committee, so I'm a little bit vague on it. We very much hand that list back to them and say, okay, you don't get an indenture or new one until this out-of-work list is gone. Or in the case of some really big programs, until the out-of-work list is much smaller. For instance, inside electrical program in Portland has over 400 apprentices just in this one program. They're never going to empty that out of work list completely, so they get down to a point of 5 or 10, and they say, okay, good enough, we can indenture new enough. So that's how that works. I want to comment that Mr. Shipwreck stated that we get apprentices and people into the industry by word of mouth. We've studied this. We've surveyed all our apprentices for the last couple of years. It's incredibly true. We have tried advertising. We've tried newspapers. We've tried you name it, Craigslist to Job Dango. It's word of mouth. It entirely is. It is the neighbor, the father, the cousin.
somebody told them about the trade. It's where we can't sell it in a newspaper for whatever reason. With that, I guess I'm open to questions.
Any questions, Representative Esquivel?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any program in place where we go into the high schools and we explain to these youngsters what exactly an apprenticeship program is, what the benefits are, what the pay scale is, what the education requirements are, et cetera, et cetera? Example in, for carpenters, electricians, plumbers, diesel mechanics, whatever. Do we have anything in place that does that consistently throughout the state of Oregon?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Esquivel, you asked the most important point last, consistency. No. We, here and there, we are invited or work our way into a high school, and we'll take a contractor or a few employees with us. And we are in there talking to classes whenever possible. In fact, I know of one situation in Sherwood, Sherwood High, maybe a week ago, where one of my employees, a couple contractors, and a couple, I think we had an electrician, an HVAC, et cetera, talked about their trades, and one student stood up and said, I want a job this summer, and we had a general contractor that can make that happen. And we were actually able to put it together. One student, one situation, but we made it happen once. The Bureau of Labor and Industry does have a brand new employee who, this is their job, is to get things going in high schools. It's a new program. I don't know how far up and running it is. I think the person just actually got hired relatively recently. They can speak to that much better. But the industry is trying to work together on the program. With that said, there are other groups like Flat Electric Supply and some folks like that who are working very hard and are willing to invest real dollars into promoting the industry. They are eager to do such things.
We understand it. It's a hit or miss depending on the school district.
Yes.
Some do a great job, others don't do as much, some don't do anything. That's the way I understand it works in Oregon.
Chair Schaffler, I would agree wholeheartedly. We find particularly the more rural the location, the more interested they are. It's kind of become slang in our area that you get a farm kid who's not working on the farm, that's a great tradesman. That's somebody we want.
Well, I can promise you, you're out there bucking hay all day, you learn what serious work is. And
exactly.
By God. And God bless every one of them, too. So, Representative Holby.
Just a follow-up to Representative Esquivel's question about that information being provided consistently. The Bureau of Labor and Industries has consistently had the requirements and pamphlets on all the apprenticeship programs in the state and provides that free to anybody. It's on their website. They have brochures at every Bureau of Labor and Industries office. They provide it to schools. They participate in career fairs all across the state. I used to run career fairs 15 years ago for about 5 years. I would go around to career fairs and tell people what was being offered through apprenticeship. The part that's not consistent is the school's advocacy. And I think everybody else is there. It's just the school systems, depending on the school district, just haven't really been informing kids of those opportunities.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holby, ditto. That's exactly our experience as well.
Any further questions for John today? All right, seeing none, thanks a lot for coming. Anybody else want to testify to this or anything else we've talked about today? Any comments from the committee? All right, well, thanks for coming in today, guys. It's been an enlightening conversation, and I'm sure we'll continue into the future. With that, I'm going to close here.